Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview mid-June 2021. And I'm joined today by Reg Hoare, Managing Director at Engine MHP, who's not here in his professional capacity, but instead as a private investor who's been diversifying his investments into crowdfunded opportunities. And he's going to tell us how he's been going about it and what it's added to his portfolio. Hi, Reg, and many thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tamsin. Great to be with you again.
So what exactly is crowdfunding?
It's essentially the practice of funding a project or a venture by raising money from a large number of people who each contribute a relatively small amount, and typically it's done by the internet. Now, our focus today is on crowdfunding of private companies, just to make that clear, and doing the crowdfunding through some very kind of well-established platforms like Crowdcube, Seeders, the Angel Investment Network.
And what drew crowdfunding to your attention and how did you get into it?
Well, it was kind of one of those entirely sort of random events that occasionally happens, in that I'd heard of crowdfunding and had thought to myself, you know, there's something I ought to, you know, look into more. But I happened to be in one of my favourite restaurants near the office, Barrafina, the Spanish tapas bar, and discovered that their parent company, Hearts, were doing a crowdfunding raise in order to open some new restaurants. And they had a very attractive incentive that if you invested a certain amount of money, you basically would get 2 free glasses of wine for each visit. So I thought, well, that's fantastic. So having to then sign up to actually put the money in, I had to sign up to the Crowdcube crowdfunding platform and, as it were, become a member of that platform. And inevitably, that then meant that I started to receive emails from Crowdcube saying, why not invest in some other opportunities? And in particular, there was the opportunity to invest in Crowdcube itself that came fairly soon after the opportunity to invest in the Barrafina tapas restaurants. And I thought, well, hang on, this is really quite interesting now that Crowdcube itself is raising money because it's quite a serious platform. And Crowdcube was backed by Draper Esprit, who many listeners will recognise as a pretty serious venture capitalist investor. And that, again, was very attractive to be able to invest alongside a quality venture capital organisation like Draper's. So from then on, I was basically caught and converted pretty quickly to becoming really very interested in this space.
So what's the difference between this and, say, Kickstarter or investing directly in a venture capital fund?
Well, firstly, thinking about the fund side of it, originally investing in venture capital was very much the preserve of high net worths. So you really had to have serious sums of money, usually £100,000 upwards, to be able to invest in a fund of some sort. So that really was outside, you know, the scope of most of us. And the difference with the likes of Kickstarter and GoFundMe is that those really are donation kind of / reward sites. So you don't actually get a share of the action. You just give a small amount of money to somebody that's trying to, you know, start a business or raise some money for a particular purpose. Whereas obviously in the case of crowdfunding, you're actually getting shares in return for your investment. So it is very clearly an investment platform, unlike those effective sort of donation sites.
So other than your few glasses of wine, what's in it for the typical investor?
Well, I think it's really about the sort of democratisation of this sort of asset class, of the venture capital asset class. So the ability for the private investor to access high growth private companies at the kind of ground floor level. You know, normally we only get that opportunity when a company IPOs many years later. And of course, in lots of cases, companies never IPO because they get taken over, you know, subsequently by other private investors. So it's that ability to access, you know, right at the beginning of the journey. It's also the democratization element of being able to invest alongside really well-known, well-regarded venture capitalist firms. So, you know, the likes of Draper Espy, for example. It's the opportunity for the second bite of the cherry. So as some will know, the key to venture capital investment is that the investments usually go through various stages of funding rounds. And typically, there may be, you know, two or three or four funding rounds before an eventual exit. And this gives the opportunity to the private investor to participate in all those subsequent investment rounds, hopefully, obviously, at higher prices as the investment value grows of the underlying business. There's a lot of tax efficiency through the EIS scheme, probably somewhere between a third and a half of the companies tend to be registered under the Enterprise Investment Scheme. There's more and more European opportunities opening up, and that's something in particular that the platforms are keen to do to get more European companies available to investors. And one can obviously then create a portfolio by making multiple relatively small investments in order to create a portfolio like one would in one's ISA or one's pension. It's relatively low cost, more expensive than obviously investing, you know, through in shares through a platform, but at 1.5% it's kind of not outrageous. Ultimately also there's actually some very engaging and surprisingly good investor relations and shareholder incentives.
It does sound quite risky. So what are the downsides?
You're right. It is risky. It's high reward, high risk, and the downsides are fairly obvious and straightforward. You know, a lot of these businesses are pre-profitability. Many of them are pretty greenfield startups. The financial information can be a little bit sketchy because obviously historically if it hasn't made money, that may be the case. There are no sort of forecasts or research out there in the market that you can, you know, check from a friendly broker. The due diligence provided by the platform, i.e. by Crowdcube or Cedars, one of the platforms, is relatively limited compared to what you expect, you know, when a company IPOs on the stock exchange, you know, and there's a prospectus. You don't get any of that. There's very limited liquidity, although interestingly, secondary marketplaces are being developed by the platforms. There are no dividends. There's a lack of visibility around timing of exit. You know, the great advantage of the stock exchange, as we all know, is that we can exit at any minute and we can get our money back, you know, literally within 24 hours, you know, in the bank. This marketplace, clearly, there is no visibility around that, and it may be a number of years before one gets the opportunity to cash out. The corporate governance is definitely weaker compared to public markets, and that's inevitable with entrepreneur-backed type businesses or entrepreneur-led businesses. And it's a relatively less well-diversified company set. So, you know, if you are somebody that likes to invest across the market and get exposure to, you know, most industries, whether consumer, financial, industrial, natural resources, whatever, you're going to find that the sectors are much narrower in terms of crowdfunding, and there's quite a heavy skew towards high growth type areas like tech and, you know, fashionable sort of happening trend areas.
What sort of return are you hoping to achieve from something that you invest in a crowdfunded opportunity?
Well, I think that's almost impossible to say because the range is literally going to be from, you know, negative zero, writing off the full investment, through to the potential for you know, multi-bagging and potentially serious multi-bagging, you know, 10 times and upwards for the really successful investments. And you can just see from the list on the left, I mean, the most obvious one is Revolut, because it's a particularly well-known name, and we now know that it's you know, a multi-billion pound business. But, you know, that shows the scope for growth in these businesses. It's still a very immature market in terms of the portfolios that one can build up, and therefore there is not as much evidence out there than, you know, compared to the stock market, where obviously we can all look at, you know, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year performance. You know, it's not that sort of market yet, but there will be more and more case studies, I think, in coming years, where we'll be able to see, you know, the performance of individual investments and sort of baskets of investments.
And when you first take the investment, can you see which other VC backers or any other large holders are taking part in it?
Yes, it's very clear right from the start. You know, when a new opportunity is listed on the platform, you can absolutely see, you know, who the backers are. And typically it's either just entrepreneur-led, and that's it. So the guys that started the business looking to raise money, you know, on Crowdcube, or it's likely to be a business where there is already venture capital backing and has been maybe even for, you know, 2 or 3 years at this point. And the round that one is participating in, you know, maybe a secondary, a tertiary, you know, round of investment. And I've listed on this slide a number of the examples of the well-known VC backers who are involved in some of these companies. Balderton is one of the most successful tech investors of the last decade. Kinnevik is a huge Swedish VC business. Octopus, I think many will know from their small cap funds. You've also interestingly got the venture businesses within some very well-known industrial and technology businesses. So, you know, Sony, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Channel 4, you know, all of them have venture businesses that invest in these companies. And Vitruvian, interestingly, is one of the private equity firms. So they're obviously, you know, they've crossed over and are doing a mixture of private equity and venture capital. So it should be a great comfort to one to be, you know, investing alongside these guys, because, you know that they have really done their due diligence, massively so. Secondly, you also know that they've got a pretty firm hand on the tiller with these companies, i.e. they will be providing advice, not just money, but also, you know, expertise, advice, their network, etc., etc. And if anything does go wrong along the way, they're pretty likely to step in and make management changes and even perhaps propose, you know, a sort of earlier exit as a solution to any issues that may arise in terms of the underlying trading of the business. So it gives me, you know, personally a great comfort to be, you know, essentially sitting alongside these guys.
And what sort of percentage of your portfolio would you put into these crowdfunded opportunities?
Well, quite a small percentage, to be frank. And looking across my sort of total stock market assets, my portfolio in this particular market is about 5% of the total sort of investments, private and public investments. And I'd say that's probably the sort of percentage that one would consider having, you know, maybe maxed out at 10%, slightly depending obviously on the size of one's, you know, total funds that one has available. But my view is that this is, you know, it's specialized investment. It's alternative investment. It's risky investment. And therefore, it's something to have effectively in a kind of side pot that, you know, is marked with, you know, long term riskier potential, but quite exciting, you know, for the future.
And do you view it as, I can lose all of that, but it's quite nice for the EIS relief? How do you view this part of your pot?
Yeah, I think the EIS relief is more a comfort that if some of the investments aren't successful, that at least one has got the tax relief back. And depending on one's gains in other parts of the portfolio and how taxable those are, you can offset the capital loss against capital gains elsewhere. So from a tax perspective, it's quite efficient. Now, obviously, one should never invest purely for the tax benefit. One should be investing because, you know, the ultimate business that one's putting one's money into, you know, is a good business that one thinks is going to go up in value over the long term. But there's no doubt that the tax benefit, it just provides a bit of a comfort factor in terms of the kind of downside risk. Because if you're putting £1,000 in, for the sake of argument, and in reality it's only costing you £600 because of the £400 of tax relief, you know, that just feels a less risky venture to be undertaking.
And is it long enough for you to see any sort of return from these investments?
No. So as you can see from the list, I've only started this portfolio back in June 2018. So it's very much work in progress. And it also very much depends on the pipeline that's coming through on the platforms. And what I found is that it comes in sort of fits and starts of things that you think, oh, now that looks interesting. And then there might be a quiet period where there's nothing much, you know, and they all look a bit too much like entrepreneur-led startups that look a bit too risky. Some of them look a bit too Dragon's Den-like. And you sort of think, well, I think I'll leave those alone. And then suddenly there'll be a rush of two or three which are backed by venture capital already, and you suddenly think, gosh, actually, I really should go after that. So two of those recent ones at the top of the list there, SeatFrog and CityMapper, two of my most recent investments, you know, both, you know, came along in a rush, you know, literally within a week of each other. But it's too early to tell in terms of how the portfolio is going to mature. So we're only 3 years in, effectively. I'd expect a bit more clarity on that, say, after about 5 years. But importantly, you can see on the third column there on the right, I've put in the ones to date where there has been some sort of corporate activity. And you can see that's 5 out of 19 on that list already have seen some sort of event. So Chip have had it was originally a convertible stock. They've converted that into ordinary shares, and they're currently doing a follow-on second round opportunity for investment. Just Park have now done a follow-on round. That issue was a convertible as well. Coconut are doing a follow-on round. That's also underway at the moment. Free Trade have had a partial exit option. Even though I only invested in it last year, they've already done another funding round with some more VCs and gave the opportunity for existing investors to exit at that point in order that the new investors could increase their shareholdings. And Crowdcube itself tried to do a merger with Cedars, its main competitor, and would you believe it, that was blocked by the Competition and Markets Authority, which I found quite extraordinary given that it's, you know, it's the internet and clearly there is massive amounts of competition, you know, globally for this type of funding activity. So that was a very bizarre decision. But anyway, the two businesses are continuing as independent entities.
So just for clarity, to exit, obviously if you're EIS, you've got to hold for 3 years anyway. But aside from that, you're very dependent on the company and their corporate actions. And you could be stuck in for years and years and years.
Absolutely. And I think that's a crucial thing to understand, is that this is patient capital. It's long-term investing. The exit strategies of these businesses, I think one should consider it to be a minimum 3 to 5 year time horizon, you know, before any potential activity takes place. It's obviously, as with the stock market, it's entirely dependent on the cycles, you know, the economic cycle, the stock market cycle, the investment cycle. Some of those exit strategies are going to be partial exits on higher valuations. So like the Free Trade one I was describing, where they do a follow-on investment round, but they give the opportunity for existing investors to exit at that point. And here's the Free Trade case study. They're amazingly already on round 8. You can see how the share price has developed over that period of time. And they have given opportunities in those most recent rounds for investors to make a partial exit. And obviously those investors have been able to do that partial exit at a very significant premium to some of those earlier rounds. So anybody that participated back in 2016 and took some money off the table in May 2021 is looking at an absolutely fantastic return. I can't even do the maths, but I think it's a few thousand percent.
And do you have a position in free trade?
Yes, so that's one on the portfolio, which I went in on that round seven, late to the party in August 2020, but I'm glad I took the opportunity. And it's trading extremely well. I mean, it's, you know, the reason it's continued to raise money and the share price is performing strongly is it as a business, as a platform, it's doing extremely well and has gained a lot of new customers over the last sort of year or two.
Just going back to the opportunities to exit, could you just expand on that a little?
Yeah, I mean, the exit routes are really the typical ones for any company, you know, whether it's private or whether it's listed on the stock exchange. You know, we can be gobbled up by, you know, via a trade sale to a competitor or peer. It could do an IPO, clearly as a private company. And I suspect many of these businesses ultimately may well go down that route. It could do a secondary sale, by which I mean that it could be bought by a private equity firm or a venture capital, another venture capital firm, as it sort of matures as a business. And that's a very typical process that these businesses kind of go through, a process of going through a number of venture capital private equity hands as they become bigger and bigger and sort of go up the scale. They do what's known as a partial exit. So it may be that, as with the free trade example, you can take some money off the table but retain a portion because they've sold some stock again to a new private equity or new venture capital investor along the way. And then there's the buy and build option, which is, you know, you keep on going. So to some extent, you know, free trade are doing that because they're through to round eight and they've been at it now for 5 years or so. You know, Revolut clearly is still in that phase of continuing to build their businesses, continue to invest in their businesses. And therefore, as a private investor, you just continue to you know, participate in that growth potential.
And in their initial information, do they generally outline what they think the exit strategy will be?
They tend not to, but you can imagine those are some of the questions that come up on the discussion forums. So as an investor, you've got a couple of weeks whilst the opportunity is open for investment in which you can ask that question. And usually they get, you know, you might end up with some fairly predictable, you know, answers, but usually you get a feel for what the management intentions are.
And once it's closed and the investment's running, do you ever get the opportunity to ask questions to management again?
Yes, again, they're very open in terms of the forums available on the site. And there are also regular newsletters. So most of the investee companies are pumping out quarterly newsletters. One or two of them have even been doing monthlies, remarkably, and are, you know, very responsive to investor inquiries. And part of the reason they do the crowdfunding is in order to get the crowd to be advocates for the business. Because obviously, if you've got, let's say, 5,000 small investors who are backing your business, those are potentially 5,000 people who could, you know, ultimately buy your product or alternatively make sure that your product is being promoted, you know, to a wider audience.
So presumably that's why the venture capitalists are interested in the crowdfunded part of it. So the private punters getting involved.
Absolutely. I think they see that as a very important part of it. That sort of, you know, the widening and broadening of the investor base helps spread the word about the business and, you know, provides that network effect.
And so how do you select your investments? How do we pick these ones that perform like Free Trade has for you?
It's good to have a methodology. I don't think it needs to be sort of too detailed and too sort of driven by the numbers, because as I explained earlier, you're not investing on the basis of PEs, yields, you know, discounts to asset values and all of those, you know, the normal stock market metrics. You're investing on a completely different basis, which is very much about feel, actually, and about, you know, one's sense around an industry or a business or, you know, a group of entrepreneurs around the idea. So lots of temptations, best to have that methodology. And what I work around is the brand names that I've heard of. So, you know, City Mapper was something I'd heard of. What Three Words I'd heard of. Free Trade I'd heard of. Nutmeg I'd heard of. Just Park I'd heard of. So these were things I thought, you know, gosh, yeah, actually I would like to invest in that because I vaguely know what it is, you know, and it's a business that's actually been around a year or two, you know, and it's begun to get some traction. We've talked about sort of investing alongside the venture capitalists. So for me, that's really important because I know, you know, how they manage their investments, the due diligence they do, the backing they give these guys is really important. I think it's really important actually also investing in businesses where a lot of the heavy lifting's already been done, by which I mean that the original technology development has already been completed. You know, the product has come to market, the service has come to market. So you're not investing in something where, you know, it could go wrong because the tech doesn't work. You know, you're investing in something which is actually proven already. It functions, it works, it's gathering customers, it's gathering assets. So I think that's really important. And thus, it's already producing operational and earning, you know, earning revenues. And you can see the growth metrics, you know, in action in terms of those numbers. The financial model, so although we can't necessarily talk about financials in the way we would with you know, stock market investments, we can at least talk about the financial model. And is it subscription-based? You know, are there recurring revenues? Those are two of the metrics which you really can analyse alongside customer growth and earnings growth. And so that, again, is something you can look at. Is it a business model that can be rolled out globally? I think that's really important. And obviously, if it's tech, you know, if it's a tech-based kind of platform-based business, clearly it can be rolled out not just out of the UK but into Europe, into the States. And many of these, the ones I've invested in, you know, already have their, you know, first launches in other countries outside the UK. On trend sector or market opportunities, I when I put some money into Fnatic, which was on the list earlier this year, I literally had never even heard of esports. And when I looked at it, I was like, I cannot believe that esports seems to be more popular than live sport. And yet there are these teams and brands out there doing it. And I noticed that there's been, I think, certainly one IPO in the sector recently on AIM. So it's clearly, you know, it's on trend. And I thought, well, I'll participate in that because it is something that's going places. And obviously things like meals, delivery, that's also very on trend at the moment. And there's one particular one I invested in, which is which hasn't completed yet, and it isn't on that portfolio, but it's a plant-based meal kit business. And obviously, as people are switching away from eating meat, and more people are going vegan or vegetarian, I think that whole area of plant-based meals looks very interesting for the longer term. Technology potential, obviously disrupting old economy markets. There's quite a lot of fintech apps, essentially around kind of banking, savings, investment, which are disruptors and I think are making probably life at the margin very difficult for the traditional bricks and mortar high street players. So I think that's, you know, those are technology potentials, very interesting. And then lastly, but not leastly, these businesses have got to have a realistic exit potential. So, you know, in the back of one's mind, one's thinking, okay, who are the natural buyers of these businesses? And clearly, if it's, you know, if it's a fintech, if it's a savings or investment or banking type app, then the obvious buyers are going to be the big high street bricks and mortar guys, you know, who haven't got that side of their business sorted out. And in order to get it sorted out, you know, we'd have to start from scratch and throw a lot of money at it. Much easier to buy one of these guys, you know, with an existing brand name. So I think that whole consolidation theme is very important in terms of thinking, okay, this might take 5 years to exit, but at least I know at the end of the line for some obvious buyers for these businesses.
And how good is the information out there? So for a listed company, you've got the annual report and accounts that's very comprehensive. You've probably got management presentations that you can look at, and you have a regular news feed. How comprehensive is the information out there?
You have to accept it's going to be pretty limited comparatively. So when you first invest on the platform and you're looking at the potential opportunities, typically there's a video explaining what the business is with the enthusiastic management team. There is typically a PowerPoint presentation, which is usually very light on numbers, but you know, and strong on the kind of narrative around, you know, what the attraction of the business is. And then there is actually quite a useful discussion forum where you can quiz the management about, you know, the business model, the financial model, you know, historic financials, et cetera, et cetera. And those forums are usually pretty open. And actually the access is greater than it would be, you know, for an IPO, if you think about it, you know, in terms of private investors being able to participate in an IPO, you never get the chance to ask the CEO a question. You know, whereas in this Crowdcube environment, you can ask a direct question on the discussion forums on the sites. So from that perspective, it's quite good and quite open. But as I say, don't expect traditional financial materials. Don't expect a prospectus. You know, it's just not as sophisticated as that, which is why having your own methodology and having a bit of a feel for what it is that you want to invest in is kind of a critical part of doing your own research into deciding what to put some money into.
And presumably it's much less regulated, so they could say whatever they like, and hopefully if there's a video, it's down to you to decide whether you trust
them
or
much,
not.
Yeah, pretty much. The entity that's regulated is Crowdcube, Cedars, you know, so the platforms are regulated by the FCA. So that gives one a degree of comfort, you know, around that. But clearly the individual businesses that are listing on the platform are not regulated in the same way. So yeah, essentially they can pretty much say what they like within reason. So there's quite a lot of, you know, one has to do one's own, you know, due diligence as far as one can do it.
Buyer beware, I think it's called.
Buyer beware, buyer beware, absolutely.
And how do you go about valuing them?
Well, again, you know, impossible from any conventional metrics. So you have to put a venture capitalist's hat on. And do it how the venture capitalists do it. Now, I'm not a great expert on their exact methodologies and their black boxes, but generally speaking, they are ignoring profitability and they are focusing absolutely on the top line growth. So for venture capital, it's all about building the top line, and the top line can mean revenues and or customers, number of customers, or it could be, in the case of a fund manager like Nutmeg, assets under management. So it's all about growing that top line, and on the basis that the profitability will come later once the business matures. So therefore, if one's doing one's own analysis, one has to think, you know, is this a big sector? So let's use the example of Nutmeg. You know, clearly fund management is a massive sector. We know there are trillions and trillions of pounds, dollars, euros being managed globally by fund managers. So for Nutmeg to grab a share of that market shouldn't be too, you know, impossible for it. And to grow it very quickly shouldn't be too impossible because, you know, it's a massive market. It can gain market share very quickly. So that sort of analysis is really what one should be doing. And similarly, you know, on the Nutmeg example, it's the number of customers as well as the funds under management, and obviously you hope that there's a relationship between the two, and the existing customers put more money with it over time, so the you know, the average funds per customer grow. So it's all about looking at those sorts of metrics. And sort of adopting the Baillie Gifford mindset. So by that I mean the mindset that enabled Baillie Gifford within their management of the Scottish Mortgage Trust to invest in all of those stocks like Amazon and Tesla, and to make a huge amount of money for their investors. And their trick was to look at, to try and analyse the business and say to themselves, right, in 10 years' time, how big could this business be? And what value would you put on it at that point? And assuming that in 10 years' time it is making a profit and so on and so forth. And they did those calculations, you know, way back when they first invested in those businesses. And they came up with the answers that, you know, these businesses could be worth, you know, very many billions of pounds because, you know, the revenues could be very many billions and the profits could be very many billions. And they realized that to buy it, you know, at the beginning, on the, when it was on that growth trajectory, it didn't matter what price they paid. And secondly, that they should continue to buy the stocks, you know, on any pullback in the share price. So, you know, if the share price comes back 20 or 30%, you know, you add to your holding because your 10-year time horizon is such that you know you're going to make money at the end of the road. So it's very much about kind of having that mindset about how big could this business be? You know, if the management team get it right, how big could Nutmeg be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time? And clearly it could be running more than, a lot more than just 2 or 3 billion, you know, of funds under management. It could be running 50 billion, 100 billion, perfectly possible. So it's it, that's, you know, the valuation process one effectively has to go through.
And since 2018, you've seen different sentiments in the capital markets. So presumably once you've bought in, there's no volatility because there's no market. But at the point of these companies raising the capital, they will be cheaper if there's less money around wanting these opportunities. And at the moment, there seems there's lots of money sloshing around that might be looking for these sort of opportunities. So do you see a big difference in the valuations at which companies are raising, whether that's a multiple of revenue or however they're valuing themselves, at different times of the market?
Yes, I think that's highly likely that you know, given there's a lot of capital around the world that is chasing opportunities, there's no doubt supply and demand is going to have an impact on valuations, and one is probably paying at the moment a little bit more than one would have been paying 18 months ago, you know, for these opportunities. But in a sense, that's where the fact that these companies have successive funding rounds gives one the opportunity to kind of pound cost average. So if you look at that free trade example, you know, where the valuation has steadily gone up, you know, through each round as the business has grown, you know, hopefully that means over time you are, you know, effectively averaging out your cost price. And it may be that, you know, round two was a cheap round, and that round four was slightly more expensive, you know, relative. Clearly round six, round seven would have been impacted in terms of the same price being paid, probably because of the pandemic and the concerns that were still, you know, at that time. And it wasn't really until the autumn of last year that you know, valuations generally started taking off.
And are there some that just don't get away at all?
Yes, correct. Actually, not, funnily enough, from those that I've tended to look at, most of them get away. And one of the skills of the platform of Crowdcube itself and Cedars is to set the expectations of the management team in terms of the amount of raise. So they'll say, right, just, you know, the management team might want to raise 250,000, and Crowdcube will say, well, actually, why don't you just go for 200? And if you get 250, that's great. You can overfund. You can get 300. You can get 350. But what you don't want to do is ask for 250 and then only get 200, and then you don't get anything, because it's got to be fully subscribed to actually then be completed and for the shares to be issued and so on.
And the platform creates the strike price. You don't. It's not a supply and demand thing.
Yeah, correct, absolutely. And the strike price is set at the beginning of the process, so it's not adjusted during the process. So there is at least that transparency right at the beginning, that you know how much, you know, you're paying for your shares and what proportion of the equity is on offer. So you can see, therefore, what the valuation of the business is, you know, the valuation, let's say for the sake of argument, you know, it's 10 million valuation, that's 10% of the equity on offer at a share price of 10p. So that is all very transparent, you know, right from the start. And that can obviously help inform your decision. But I go back to the Bailey Gifford methodology. Don't get put off by what might look like a scarily high valuation, because that's the nature of venture capital investing. You know, if you're investing at that startup point, a point a year or two in, it is going to look quite a scary valuation compared to a typical stock market valuation. But remember, we're talking about companies that are growing at, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50% per annum for the sake of argument, 5 to 10 years. Whereas in the stock market, you know, we might be paying P's of 15 or 20 for companies that are growing at single digits.
And anyone that I talk to that does EIS investing say their success rate is very, very poor. So what would you say your success rate with this would be? How many opportunities have you bought into?
So there's about, I think there's 19 on that list, and there's a couple more that I'm currently going through the process of doing at the moment. I mean, I would guess that it's a classic 80-20 situation where probably, you know, 80% of them are going to be quite so-so. You might lose money, you might make a little bit, they might be not that exciting. And probably 20% of them could be absolutely spectacular.
And how many do you think will completely go to nothing?
I think there's probably, it slightly depends on the ones you choose. I'd like to think I've chosen ones which have got a bit more longevity because they're not startups, they're not complete startups, and because many of them are backed by some serious investors who I think will find an exit come what may. So I think that the number of those on that list that will go completely bust, I would say, you know, completely off the top of my head, I would say probably less than 20%. But who knows? I mean, I speculate.
And when would you expect that you will have got out of all of these investments? They've come to fruition. They've given you a payout. You know, when should we catch up again? How many centuries' time should we catch up again in order to hear the outcome?
Well, I'm 3 years in, aren't I? So I think probably at the five-year point, it might be quite interesting, because that's the sort of classic, you know, venture capital kind of life cycle. But I think equally, I mean, I'm going to keep topping this portfolio up modestly. So in 5 years' time, I might have, you know, 30 or 40 investments. So, and it may be that some of these things are going to move more quickly. I mean, given that we, you know, the economy is now in a very strong position, given the stock market equally has moved ahead very quickly, and it looks like, you know, we're in for a period of sort of strong capital markets generally, then it may be some of these things will move very quickly, you know, compared to, let's say, if we were talking this time last year, you know, I'd be a much more cautious, saying, ooh, you know, this could be quite a few years before anything happens with any of these. But actually, we've seen that things are happening very quickly at the moment. And actually, we're seeing it in the stock market, aren't we, too, with some of the takeover bids. So I think things are really, you know, there's a significant increase in the velocity of corporate activity as a result of, you know, the economies globally recovering. So it may be that things are going to happen more quickly than one thinks. But to be conservative, probably it's a two-year catch-up, and maybe we should have a think about it in a year's time and see where we're at, whether we need to bring that forward.
And it seems pretty much tech-focused. Do you think that the crowdfunding marketplace will move out? You know, investing has become a bit more value-focused recently. We've got inflation on the horizon. Do you think the crowdfunding market sectors will open up?
Maybe up to a point. I mean, it's obviously, you know, it is venture capital, and therefore, by definition, the industries that it's investing in are going to be more, you know, cutting edge, growth oriented, you know, trend spotting, trend following, and therefore, by definition, there's going to be that skew to technology. So I think it's probably realistic that it will continue to be quite, you know, quite tech driven. And it's unlikely there's going to be a lot of kind of what we might call bricks and mortar type businesses. But that's just the nature of venture capital.
So in a nutshell, Reg, sum up crowdfunding opportunities.
So I think as we discussed, it's high risk, it's high reward, it won't be for everybody. But as part of a kind of diversified portfolio, I think it has a place within that portfolio for some sort of high risk, high reward opportunities. It's about being patient. It's patient capital investing. We've talked about 3 to 5 year time horizons. It's probably longer than that in many cases. It is regulated by the FCA, so that's good news. Self-certification is required re one's personal wealth. So one needs to be a sophisticated investor in order to access these opportunities. One's in good company. One's investing alongside some pretty serious venture capital investors, which does give comfort. The EIS tax relief is an important element of managing the risk around these investments. But the potential, if one's portfolio matures in the way that it hopefully will, is to hopefully pick up some multi-baggers and make some serious wonga.
Reg, many thanks indeed. And tell people where they can find you.
So you can find me on Twitter at Reg Hoare. All one word, where I occasionally pontificate about investing activities. And now we've done this video, I will post a little bit more about what I'm up to on the crowdfunding front.
Superb. Thank you very much. And to all our listeners, you can find many more educational and entertaining investing videos at piworld.co.uk. Many thanks for listening and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.